I'd like now to welcome Jared Diamond. He's a professor of geography at the University of California in Los Angeles. He's a recipient of numerous awards, including a MacArthur Foundation Fellowship. His book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, won the Pulitzer Prize, and his latest book is The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? Welcome, Jared Diamond, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
The subtitle of the book is What We Can Learn from Traditional Societies. What do we mean by traditional society?
Good question. Traditional societies are all human societies for the last 200,000 years of human existence until about 10,000 years ago when societies got to become non-traditional. Traditional means small societies of a few hundred people. That's how everybody lived until relatively recently. Societies in which everybody knows everybody by name. There aren't strangers, and if you see a stranger, it's rare and dangerous. People gather or grow their own food. People grow up and spend their lives with the same people, and they are not manufactured tools, so the tools are instead made of stone and wood and bone. That's how everybody used to live. Even in the modern world, there have still been tribal peoples, recently in New Guinea and in the Amazon, who are still living in that traditional way, and they're contrasted with what you and I and all our listeners are used to, namely modern industrial societies, where there are millions of people, you encounter hundreds of strangers every day, you eat food grown by somebody else, and you use metal and plastic tools.
Now, you've spent a lot of time in New Guinea over the course of 50 years, and that's a place where you had, and to some extent still have, traditional society and a great diversity of ways of life and languages. And as you write in the book, I mean, New Guinea is one place, but there are many things there that can generalize to traditional societies. Tell us about that.
Sure. New Guinea does have traditional societies. That's to say, until relatively recently, most New Guineans were living in isolation using stone tools. They didn't have state government writing. And there are lots of societies in modern times that were traditional like that in Africa and South America and Australia. But let's not think that it's only exotic peoples elsewhere that are traditional, because in the United States, in rural areas of the United States, for example, in Montana, where my wife and kids and I spend our summers, there's still much traditional about society. For example, neighboring Montana ranchers, if they get into a dispute with each other, they don't call in the police or hire lawyers, because they know that that rancher on the other side of the fence is going to be there for the next 50 years. And to settle the dispute, you got to remain on friendly terms with him, that, rather, or him or her, rather than pull in the police. So disputes in rural areas of the U.S. are still settled in traditional ways. And that illustrates that traditional societies, there's still a lot that's traditional within even modern American society.
You write about dispute resolution in all kinds of places, and I mean, as you say, just like in Montana, New Guinea, these disputes take place in a context where there's no formal law enforcement system or justice system, and people have to see each other for the rest of their lives, even if they do heinous things to each other. What are some ways in which conflicts are resolved and settled?
First and foremost, in traditional societies, because just as you say, you're going to have to deal with that person for the rest of your life. It's not like the American cities where if you have a traffic accident, it's with someone that you never saw before and you're never going to see again. So in traditional societies, what's important about resolving a dispute is to permit you to get along with that person for the rest of your life. And what's unimportant is right and wrong and how much the object was worth. Whereas a fender bender in an American city, who cares whether that other person hates you for the rest of his or her life? What you care about is the value of your fender or your car. So the focus in traditional dispute resolution is to maintain a relationship, whereas anybody who's had the misfortune to be involved with the American civil or criminal justice system knows that the American courts don't care at all about whether you end up hating the other person. What American courts care about is right or wrong. And where that gets tragic is when you have disputes between, say, divorcing husbands and wives who are going to have to deal with each other over children, or brothers and sisters locked in an inheritance dispute. Anyone with experience in those cases knows that the American courts usually make things much worse so that the husband and wife have difficulty speaking to each other, or the brother and sister, because of the courts, hate each other so much that they never speak for the rest of their lives. So that's the big difference between traditional and modern dispute resolution.
Do you see ever in traditional societies feuds that go on for years or generations?
Yes, certainly. In modern state societies, generally we do not have feuds, particularly feuds that take violent form, because the state government makes sure that if you're angry at someone, you do not take justice in your own hands and go kill or beat up the other person. If you try to do that, the state will put you into jail. So the essence of states, whether they are American states or any powerful state, is you do not want people carrying out private feuds. Whereas in contrast, in traditional societies, whether they're in New Guinea or elsewhere, because there's not a central government and there's not a police and there's not a king or president and there aren't courts and lawyers, if there's a dispute and you don't succeed in settling the dispute, then people do take the dispute into their own hands. They may resort to violence without police to prevent them from doing it, and that's why you do get feuds that can go on for a long time.
Now, you describe a kind of social evolution from band, which is a small group of maybe a few families, to tribe, to chiefdom, each step ever larger, and then to state. And each step up has increasing population, increasing specialization and hierarchy. And for there to be states with common governance over a wide geographical area, you have to have agriculture. Why? How does this work?
You have to have agriculture to have states, because states arise only when there are lots of people. When humans were hunter-gatherers, which all of us were until 10,000 years ago, for hunter-gatherers, there's not that much food out there in the environment, in the desert or in a forest. And so hunter-gatherers are always living at low population densities in small groups of a few dozen up to a few hundred people. Once you get agriculture, though, then all the plants and animals can be ones that are edible. You've got a wheat field where every plant there is edible wheat rather than a forest where you've got a berry bush every half mile or so. And so agriculture, when it began 10,000 years ago, permitted a population explosion. For the first time, we had societies of thousands or tens of thousands, or now in the United States, 310 million people. So once you get a big society, you can't make decisions face-to-face in a discussion as you can in a group of a few dozen people. You've got to have a government in order to make decisions and to do the administration. And that's why agriculture was essential for the development of popular state societies with police and kings and presidents and tax collectors and all those other things that we complain about but that are necessary.
Why did some parts of the world go in that direction, agriculture and states, and others not?
That's one of the biggest questions of history. Why did agriculture and states develop in some parts of the world but not in other parts? For example, here I am sitting in California, which is now the most productive farmland in the United States, and yet when Europeans came to California, California Indians, Native Americans, they were not farmers. They were hunter-gatherers, although California today is great farmland. The reason turns out to be that in order to be a farmer, you got to have wild plants and animals that it's possible to domesticate and modify and grow yourself. But most plant and animal species cannot be domesticated, and so it's only in a few parts of the world, such as the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East and such as China and Mexico, that there were enough plants and animals to be domesticated and permit farming. That's the reason why farming took off in some areas in a few parts of the world, from which it then spread, but not in other parts.
We're talking to Jared Diamond about his book, The World Until Yesterday. One thing that I found fascinating was that, as you write, traditional societies are much more diverse in their practices and their languages and so on than modern state societies. What does that diversity look like, and why are they so much more diverse?
Interesting question. So what does the diversity look like, and why are they so diverse? As for what the diversity looks like, it means that in New Guinea, in the highlands of New Guinea, when you walk 10 miles, on the average, every 10 miles, you encounter a new tribe with a different language and with different customs. And the reason for that is that New Guinea traditionally never had any state government which homogenizes, which imposes its own practices over a wide area. Whereas Europe acquired state government a couple of thousand years ago, China acquired state government a couple of thousand years ago. And once you get a state, the state homogenizes. The state often imposes its own language, just as the United States imposes English. The state imposes its own customs, its own police. And so societies with a central government are much more homogeneous than are traditional societies.
It's interesting. I mean, as I was reading your book, I was thinking about, okay, this evolution toward increasing complexity and division of labor, which seems so analogous to cellular evolution, from evolution from single-celled and multicellular organisms to much more complex creatures like us with specialization and division of labor. Do you see this as an analogy?
Yes, you can make an analogy. It is the case that with cellular evolution, several billion years ago, there were single cells, and somewhat before half a billion years ago, single cells were aggregating into multicellular organisms, and eventually you got large creatures such as dinosaurs and whales and others. So yes, you can make the analogy. As with any analogy, analogies are illustrative, but you shouldn't press them too far, and you shouldn't say that human societies are like multicellular jellyfish, because they're not.
So let's talk for a moment about wars in traditional society. First of all, are they ubiquitous? Do all traditional people have wars?
No, they're not ubiquitous. Just as in state societies, some state societies have wars and some don't. Sweden and Switzerland haven't had a war for over 150 years. So you can't say that all state societies have wars. But certainly there are plenty of state societies that do have wars, including the United States and Britain and Germany and so on. Similarly, with traditional societies, there are some that are relatively peaceful and some that have wars. What one can say is that the majority of traditional societies do have wars, just as the majority of societies with state governments have had wars.
And so what do they fight over? I mean, you give some examples in the book, women and pigs, sorcery and land. Tell us about some of these disputes and how they lead to war.
Sure. So what do they fight over? Just as with modern societies, you get a different answer if you ask people what you fight over from the answer you get if historians study what they really fight over. So, for example, in New Guinea, if you ask New Guineans, what are you fighting over? The usual answer is women or pigs. And with due respect, there's an equivalence there in that traditionally in New Guinea, women were bought and the price for women was often paid in pigs. So the typical cause for a fight in New Guinea is a dispute over women. We bought your daughter, but then she ran away and we want our pigs back. But the pigs have already been eaten. The underlying reason, though, I mean, all New Guineans have women and pigs, but not all New Guineans fight. And so there's an underlying reason, which is thought to be often involve arguments about space or arguments about resources. That's to say, groups want space territory for themselves. But we're used to that on reflection also in modern state-level societies. So, for example, World War I. Why did World War I, the war that killed more people than any other war in human history, why did World War I break out? The short answer is because there was a Serbian nationalist who shot the Archduke of Austria and his wife. But there are nationalists who are shooting people all over the world. why did that particular shooting produce the biggest war in human history? So there were underlying causes to World War One, quite apart from the shooting of the Archduke. And those underlying causes have to do with competition for resources, and they have to do with the alliance system, and they have to do with nationalism.
It's interesting to contrast the fact that people go to war over pigs and women, for example, but if there is a dispute within the society, they work it out in a completely different way. And, I mean, these are people, you're often talking about people who live very close to each other, who live a few miles away. Do they ever use techniques of dispute resolution to get along with each other instead of going to war?
Absolutely. As you say, if the dispute is within a society, within your village of a few hundred people, you can bet that you try to resolve the dispute peacefully rather than ending up fighting, because the last thing you want is a fight within your own small society. But it's also the case that if there's a dispute between neighboring societies, often, perhaps usually, the first attempt made is to settle the dispute peacefully by, for example, if the dispute is over a pig or a woman, you see if you can reach an agreement, either the woman comes back or you pay the pigs back. But what one can say is that there's more pressure to settle the dispute peacefully within a society than between neighboring societies. Because within a society, everybody is related to everybody else. You're really reluctant to start beating up your own brothers. Whereas between adjacent societies, there are fewer close relatives, and so there's less inhibition about turning to fighting.
Now, how do warring groups deal with each other after their wars are over?
Well, after the war is over, the war may go on for a long time. But eventually, the groups may decide that we want peace because it really is terrible being in a constant state of fear and not being able to develop a garden for fear that you'll be ambushed in the garden. And so often a war ends, I would say typically a war eventually ends with reconciliation, say with a feast of reconciliation. For example, one New Guinea friend of mine, whose father had in fact been killed by a neighboring group, told me that something like 25 years later, his group succeeded in making peace with the neighboring group, and they did it in the course of a feast where lots of pigs were killed, and both sides agreed that each had by now killed an equal number of people on the other side. It really made for a miserable existence to be afraid about being ambushed all the time. So both groups were anxious to have peace, and they achieved peace by a reconciliation feast and a pig feast.
Now, how, in your view, do the motives for war among traditional people compare to the motives for war among us in industrial society with these incredibly highly developed militaries and anonymous ways of killing each other and so on?
In traditional societies, the motives for war, because the society is small, the motives for war are also what you would call smaller motives, namely, he stole my pig, and he says, no, it wasn't your pig, and besides, the pig was wandering around, and it came to me, so I didn't steal the pig. The pig just came to me. Whereas the United States and Canada would never go to war about pigs. The United States and Canada nowadays wouldn't go to war. The United States and Mexico did go to war 150 years ago, and it was basically because the United States wanted a large chunk of Mexican territory. But traditional societies also go to war partly, ultimately, for territory, although usually they wouldn't say we went to war in order to get the territory of those other people. Usually they would say we went to war because they stole our pig.
I think it's important to note that although we seem, in the United States, to have this, crazily developed military, and we're always fighting wars, certainly in the last 10 years we've been in a constant state of war. The reality is that industrial society is, on the whole, more peaceful than traditional society. Is that really true?
That is true, and it's initially surprising. If 10 years ago you had told me modern industrial societies are more peaceful than traditional societies, I would have said, who are you kidding? That is obscene. Why on earth are you saying that modern industrial societies are peaceful when I was 8 years old at the time of the Hiroshima bomb or the Nagasaki bomb that killed 100,000 people in a fraction of a second? Whereas in tribal societies, the largest number of people that I ever heard of being killed in a New Guinea war at one time was 125 people. So it seems ridiculous to suggest that tribal societies have more violent wars. But the explanation becomes clear when you reflect that traditional societies, they're smaller. There are only a few hundred people, so obviously you can't kill 100,000 people in a society of a few hundred people. In order to make a comparison, what you would talk about is the percentage of people who meet violent deaths. And there, dozens and dozens of studies around the world have shown that the percentage of people who die violent deaths really is higher on the average, with exceptions, in traditional societies than in modern state-level societies for reasons that become obvious on reflection, namely that we've got governments to make peace treaties and to prevent hotheads from starting the war again, whereas traditional societies don't have centralized governments to make peace. Also, in modern state war, only a fraction of the population fights. Today, the United States has a professional army. And even in World War II, when we had a draft, the people who were fighting were men between the ages of 18 and 28 or 32. Whereas in traditional societies, everybody ends up fighting, not just the adult men, but the women and the kids down to 6 years old as well. So that's why the proportional death toll is higher. And as I say, initially that surprises lots of people.
We're talking to Jared Diamond about his book, The World Until Yesterday. Now, you encountered a different way of assessing danger and risk than what you had been used to, and you call it constructive paranoia. What is that?
Sure. Constructive paranoia is good, and paranoia is not good. Paranoia is a term for a psychological or psychiatric condition, which means greatly exaggerated fears for which you should consult a therapist. Constructive paranoia is a term that I used for fears that may seem exaggerated, but really make sense when you start thinking clearly. So let me give you a banal example in modern American society. Today, I've already done the most dangerous thing that I'll do all day today, and that is I took a shower. Now, many people would say, Jared Diamond, for heaven's sakes, what's so dangerous about taking a shower? Well, read the obituary column of any newspaper any day, and you'll see, in fact, that particularly for older people, a common cause of getting crippled or losing quality of life or even killed is falling in the shower or falling on the stairs or on a stepladder or on a sidewalk. And again, someone may say, well, look, Jared, what's your chance of slipping in the shower? 1 in 1,000? If you're afraid of slipping in the shower, your fears are exaggerated. And I'd say, yes, 1 in 1,000, for heaven's sakes, do the numbers. So I'm 76 years old. My life expectancy now is another 15 years till age 91. So if my chance of slipping in the shower were 1 in 1,000, with 15 years of life ahead of me times 365 days per year, with luck, I have 5,475 showers ahead of me. And if my chance of killing myself in each hour is 1 in 1,000, then with 5,475 showers ahead of me, I'm going to kill myself 5.5 times before reaching my life expectancy. So that's why, from New Guineans who have to learn to think carefully about danger because there aren't doctors and hospitals to bail them out, from New Guineans I've learned to be attentive to the dangers of things that we do every day, and each time the risk is low, but eventually the risk will catch up with you. And so showers and falling, one thing, but of course driving cars and alcohol and electric appliances in the kitchen, those are other big risks of daily life. Each time the risk is low, but you do it every day and it'll catch up with you unless you practice Jared Diamond-like constructive paranoia.
Right. Now, I think about our own society's irrationalities about risk. We worry about and spend a lot of money responding to terrorism and illegal drugs more than we do responding to climate change, when the latter is pretty clearly a much, much greater threat to human life and food supply and everything like that. Is there anything that we can learn from traditional societies that would help us respond to those kinds of big risks in a more realistic way?
Yes, that's a really interesting point that you mentioned. The confused thinking about risks in modern American or modern industrial society compared with much clearer thinking in traditional societies. So you ask the average American, what are the things you're really concerned about? And the answer you get will probably be terrorists and plane crashes and genetically modified crops and DNA. And then ask yourself, how many Americans do you know personally who got killed by terrorists or got killed in plane crashes? I know one American who was killed in a plane crash, and I don't know any American who was killed by genetically modified crops, whereas I have lots of people in my immediate circle, my closest relatives, most of them, have had serious accidents from falling. In New Guinea, New Guineans are not at risk from falling in showers because they don't have showers. Instead, what they are at risk from and think clearly about is the danger of falling trees. If you're going to spend your life in a forest, you had better not sleep out under a dead tree. And that, in fact, was the wake-up experience for me. I was with New Guineans, and I proposed to make a camp, camping out under a beautiful tree, and the New Guineans with me said, we're not going to sleep there. The tree is dead. And my reaction was, you're paranoid. That tree isn't going to fall over tonight. It'll stand for 50 years. But then I started doing the numbers, and I realized if the chance of a dead tree falling over on you is 1 in 1,000 that particular night, but if you're going to sleep in the forest every night, and every night you sleep under dead trees, with 365 days in a year, in 3 years, 1,095 days, a 1 in 1,000 risk of the dead tree falling over means that you'd be dead in 3 years. So New Guineans, because they don't have doctors to help them, New Guineans have to think much more clearly about dangers than do we Americans. And it's from New Guineans that I've learned my constructive paranoia.
You write about the vast differences in child rearing in traditional societies, and there's a huge variation among traditional societies in how they rear their children, but there do seem to be some common practices, many of which have to do with physical contact between children and their caregivers. What does this look like, and how does it affect the way these children grow up?
Yeah, really interesting question, and that's something which people who have read my book often find as the most practical lesson from my book, namely how to bring up your children. The thing that strikes me in New Guinea, and I think that strikes most Americans who've spent some time in traditional societies in Africa or Central or South America, is how self-confident and self-assured and independent and capable of making decisions their children are. 5 or 10-year-old kids in New Guinea, they're capable of negotiating with an adult, making up their own minds. They don't ask their parents. They make their own decisions. And the result is that when they become teenagers, because they've been making decisions for their whole life, they don't have the horrible problems often of American teenagers who achieve the bodies of adults, but they haven't been making decisions, and so they've got the bodies of adults, but they don't have the decision-making abilities of adults. The way that people in traditional societies raise their kids so that the kids become independent and self-confident and socially skilled, there are several ways. One is, in carrying your baby, you don't push your baby horizontally in a baby carriage. You carry your baby vertically upright, facing forwards. That's something really simple for any of us to do. But if a baby is looking forwards, the baby sees the same field of view as the parent. That's better for developing neuromotor skills and developing self-confidence. Children are allowed to make their own decisions much more than our micromanaged American children. New Guineans carry it further than my wife and I were willing to carry. In New Guinea, babies are allowed to play near fires, and it's for the baby to figure out whether to roll into the fire. Well, that was carrying it further than my wife and I were willing to do with our kids, but we did allow our kids to make their own decisions insofar as it wouldn't kill them or hurt them. And just as an example, one of my sons at age 3 saw a snake for the first time in his life, and it was love at first sight. He was just fascinated by that snake. He demanded a snake as a pet. All right, he's a 3-year-old has made his own decision. We got him a snake. It was a non-poisonous snake as a pet, and he got more and more snakes until in our house we had 147 of his pet snakes and frogs and lizards and salamanders. And he went through his snake stage for about 10 to 15 years. Then he got less interest in snakes. And now he's made a career. He made his choice. He decided that his career is not going to be in snakes, but he became a restaurant chef. All right, this is a boy who from 3 years old onwards was making his own decisions, unlike our micromanaged American children.
You hear a lot of arguments that seem supposedly based in science, or they're claimed to be based in science, about how the adolescent brain is just not ready to really make decisions and so on. And I think the argument is that you shouldn't let children or adolescents do things like drink or drive or whatever, make their own decisions, until they're really adults. And yet, the way you talk about traditional societies, I mean, there's an example in your book of a 14-year-old girl who you had last seen when she was 12, then you came back, she was 14, and she was a mother, and at first you thought, she can't be 14, and then when you saw that she was 14, you said, well, she shouldn't be ready for this, but you realized that she was as ready or more ready than you were when you had children at a much later age.
That's right. So as far as teenagers are concerned, you are perfectly correct that American teenagers, I as a teenager, was not ready to make my own decisions because I didn't have a life experience of making decisions. But New Guinea children do have a life experience of making decisions. And so that 14-year-old girl, when I came back, I had met her when she was 12, and I came back to her village 2 years later, and there she is with a baby. And, you know, my first question, anybody's first question is, how do you know she's 14? Well, her father kept the village records, and he showed me the village birth book, and yes, she really was 14. Well, by the time she became a mother at age 14, the reality was that she had much more experience handling babies than I did when I became a father at age 49 and a half, because as a 14-year-old, she had been taking care of her little sisters and brothers for 12 years, and so at age 14, she was ready to become a mother. And similarly, New Guineans and Africans and other people in traditional societies, when they're teenagers, they're ready to become farmers and they're ready to play a important role in the society because they have not been micromanaged and they've been making decisions all their lives. And so when they're a teenager, they're ready for it, unlike kids in the United States.
I wonder if you did this kind of brain science study on New Guinean kids, whether they would just have much more developed brains than their corresponding American teenagers.
I don't think it's much more developed brains organically. I'm sure that a New Guinea brain is like an American brain. It's just that they have much more experience. They've enjoyed much more freedom making decisions and making mistakes and learning from their mistakes.
We're talking to Jared Diamond about his book, The World Until Yesterday. So let's talk now about health and disease and old age, which are also very different in the places that you describe. For example, traditional people in so many places tend not to get heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes. There's even a lower rate of cancer. Is the difference between them and us as simple as diet and exercise?
A short answer would be yes. The fact is that traditional New Guineans essentially never got type 2 diabetes or heart disease or stroke. And right there, we've got the commonest causes of death of Americans. Most of us, you and I, and probably most of our listeners, will die, most of us, of those so-called non-communicable diseases They're diseases that are not infectious. They can't be passed from one person to another. They're diseases of lifestyle. There was a just as I was arriving in New Guinea for the first time in the early 1960s, there was a study of hospital admissions in the biggest hospital in New Guinea, 2,000 hospital admissions. And among 2,000 New Guineans going into the hospital, there was not a single person going into the hospital for diabetes, heart disease. There were four people who came in because of high blood pressure, but it turned out that those four were not New Guineans. They were foreigners in New Guinea. But now that New Guineans have been increasingly adopting the Western lifestyle, they're getting heart disease and diabetes and stroke just like us. The features of lifestyle that result in Americans dying of diabetes and stroke, but New Guineans not, they're, many of them are well known. They consist of that we eat too much, we don't exercise enough, we consume lots of sugar, we consume lots of salt, New Guineans don't have salt. The average American in one day consumes as much salt as a New Guinean in nearly a year. But salt is one of the main risk factors for stroke and high blood pressure. So there are, of course, increasing numbers of Americans who've learned their lesson from what they hear about lifestyle. And like my wife and we don't have a salt shaker in our kitchen. We don't salt our food. And we don't use much sugar. I personally don't eat much bread and pastry and cakes. We eat lean meat. We eat lots of fruits and vegetables. That's the healthy diet that humans ate for the last couple of 100,000 years until the rise of agriculture that propelled us onto a unhealthy diet that gives these non-communicable diseases. So there's a simple example. Well, I say simple. There's a very clear example of how you can do yourself a lot of good, namely improve your quality of life and live longer by learning from traditional societies.
And yet they have a shorter life expectancy than we do. What illnesses do they get, and what is their end of life like?
That's right. They do have a shorter life expectancy than us. What they die of is infectious diseases, such as malaria and dysentery, because traditionally they didn't have antibiotics. They died of starvation and not enough food, because they don't have supermarkets and pantries full of canned goods. They died of accidents, of falling, of slipping, of getting swept away in rivers, whereas we've tamed our environment. And they died of violence because they didn't traditionally have police and judges and courts. So yes, you're right that the traditional lifespan is shorter than the modern lifespan. Traditionally, lifespan was 40, 50 years. In the United States, lifespan is now 78. In Japan, it's 86. So this raises another important point. I'm not saying I love the traditional lifestyle, and so that's why I'm leaving the United States and going to live in New Guinea. I'm very happy to be living in Los Angeles and going to visit New Guinea, but being based in Los Angeles, because, yes, there are advantages to the modern life. But while getting the advantages of the modern life, we can also incorporate advantages of the traditional life, such as avoiding non-communicable diseases, raising our children to be self-confident, thinking clearly about dangers, enjoying a better quality of life in old age, and other examples.
One fascinating thing about New Guinea is, as you wrote, the average person there spoke, I don't know if they still do, but for a while they spoke like five languages, not dialects, but full-on languages. Presumably, these are languages of people of other tribes or other groups that live around them that they are in potential conflict with. How did they learn those languages?
Oh, they learn those languages because the people around them, while you say they're in potential conflict with them, yes, but they're also in potential friendly relationships, and more of the time they're in friendly relationships than in conflict. If you're in a small group of a few dozen people, everyone in the group is your, if not your brother or sister, is your cousin or your second cousin. And so when you're ready to marry, you're going to marry someone from another group because you don't want to marry you've got taboos against marrying your cousin. But those neighboring groups are likely to speak different languages. And you're right, they're not different dialects. They're different languages, as different as English is from Chinese. So in traditional societies, it's often the case that the mother and father are from different groups, and they therefore speak different languages as their first languages, which means that babies grow up bilingual, but then there are the neighboring groups that speak other languages. So New Guineans, in my experience, New Guineans typically speak five languages or more, whereas in the United States, we know that multilingualism is controversial. There are lots of Americans who think, oh, it's really bad to bring up babies to be bilingual or multilingual, but the fact is that in traditional societies for the last, as long as we know, thousands of years, most babies have been bilingual or multilingual. In fact, it turns out now that it's a big advantage to be bilingual or multilingual. It's the best protection that we know against the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease of old age to be bilingual or multilingual, because multilingualism is constant exercise of the brain.
Not to mention the fact that it opens people up to multiple cultures and ways of life.
That's right. Being bilingual or multilingual it permits you to converse with other people whose way of life is different from yours. It permits you to grow into different styles of living and dealing with things. It permits you to learn different cultures. So there's, in short, it permits you to have a richer life, but there are lots of Americans whose inclination would be to say, don't tell me that highfalutin stuff about a richer life. It's hard work learning another language, and it's bad to force someone to learn another language, so I'm not going to learn another language. I think people who are resistant to learning another language may be more impressed by this recent research showing that being bilingual gives you, on the average, 5 years of protection against the symptoms of Alzheimer's disease.
I'm not really sure if this is a question about language, but I was thinking about the study of birds that you were doing in New Guinea, and I wondered, how is your perception of and relation to birds similar to or different from New Guineans? Do you understand and speak about birds in a similar way?
Constantly. One reason that I get along well with New Guineans is that what I do makes sense to them. So when I'm in New Guinea, I want to study birds. Every scrap of land in New Guinea is owned by someone, so to study birds anywhere, I don't just walk onto their land. I ask permission. And I explain to them, I'm interested in birds, and I want to watch birds, and I know that you know a lot about birds, so will you walk along with me, and we'll talk about birds, and you tell me what you know about birds. They're delighted to have a European who's interested in something that makes sense, namely birds, and who can talk with them about something that they know a lot about, rather than a European who comes in there and picks up rocks and wants to know about rocks, whereas New Guineans care about rocks for making stone tools, but they don't care about shiny rocks. And so in comes a European who either wants to dig up rocks because it's gold or wants to dig a hole in the ground and get some black stuff from the hole, which is oil. That doesn't make sense to New Guineans.
I wanted to ask you about gender roles. There are some practices that are quite horrifying to most readers, I would think, that you write about in your book. One of them is the most dramatic one, perhaps being widow strangling. Do you know have you encountered any traditional societies where there is true equality between men and women, equal rights, equal status and respect?
Never. I have never encountered such a society. I've never heard of such a society. There have been lots of studies and observations by anthropologists of gender roles in traditional societies. There have been summaries of gender roles in 100 traditional societies, and sadly, there's not a single case of a traditional society with equality across the board. There are, of course, societies in which women are more equal in some respects than in other respects. There are societies where women may have more economic equality or more political equality, but there is not a society where, on the average, women enjoy equality. The greatest gender role equality that we know of in any society is today in modern industrial Scandinavia.
Yeah, it's interesting because, again, reading your book, first of all, there's so many ways in which you see traditional culture and the way it works in our contemporary industrial society. And to see the vestiges of that is, I think, very helpful and instructive. And also, it's like we, on some level, as you've mentioned, get to pick what aspects we want. And I was wondering about that. I mean, can you just pick this and that and not the other thing? Are societies a coherent whole? Can you take pieces in isolation?
You as an individual can pick. Society as a whole has more difficulty picking. Some things that you as an individual can pick are that even though my neighbors may be using lots of salt on their food, I can still choose not to sprinkle salt on my food regardless of what my neighbors are doing. And even if my neighbors are pushing their babies horizontally in baby carriages, we chose to carry our babies upright facing forwards. That's something that you can decide individually. There are other things that you can't decide individually that only society as a whole can decide. And for example, if you think that the American court system is no good and makes disputes worse by focusing on right and wrong, I cannot go out and change the American court system. Only the American government can change the American court system. So the point you make is an important one. It illustrates there are some things from traditional societies we can adopt as individuals and some things that require action on the part of society as a whole. But there are things that whole societies have learned from traditional societies. There are, for example, quite a few countries where the government has decided it's bad for the public health of our people to have lots of salt in food, and so the government has worked together with food manufacturing companies in reducing the amount of salt in processed food year after year. That's happened in Finland, where the frequency of heart disease has gone down by more than 50% in a few decades as a result of a government campaign. It's also happened in Portugal and in some provinces in China. So that's an important point that you raise.
The book is called The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? And I think this question is an urgent one for many of us because our industrial way of life is causing so much harm. Do you see this as a way of addressing directly or indirectly those kinds of harms that we're doing to ourselves?
Certainly, in some respects, yes. A prime example is the epidemic of non-communicable diseases that you and I were talking about, the explosion of diabetes in many, I would say, in all developed countries. So that's an area where we can learn from traditional societies. As for the big problems facing the world today, problems of climate change, problems of nuclear weapons, problems of equality among the world's peoples, those, I would say, are new problems that we have to face on our own terms and figure out the solutions for ourselves, because traditional people did not have nuclear weapons. On the other hand, traditional peoples did have to think clearly about dangers, and we certainly have to think clearly about nuclear weapons and global warming. Perhaps their traditional peoples can inspire us to think clearly about the real dangers facing modern American society.
Jared Diamond is author of the new book, The World Until Yesterday, What Can We Learn from Traditional Societies? Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
You are welcome. It's been a pleasure to talk with you.